You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to our weekly AL Central podcast. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. Pleased to be talking ball with you here in the dead of winter. And if you are in the dead of winter temperatures, I'm sure you got spring training on your mind. But in the meantime, there's still a lot of unfinished business in baseball's hot stove season. And some of that unfinished business is in the AL Central. The Tigers made another huge splash this week with the signing of Justin Upton. The Royals deepened their rotation with the signing of Ian Kennedy. We'll be talking about that. We'll catch up with all of our insiders from each team to see what the latest is. And we're also playing a little game of getting to know you, where we'll talk about some new faces on your favorite club. So let's get to it. Okay, that payroll keeps inching up. Ian Kennedy now aboard, 5 years, $70 million, and he has an opt-out after 2 years. Which is all the rage these days, the old two-year opt-out. But that actually fits in well with the whole Royals, this window, really, with this group. And just your thoughts in general. I mean, we knew that the Royals were seeking rotation help. It wasn't quite as certain they'd do something to this level. What were your thoughts on this move?
Yeah, just a little surprised at how they keep finding more and more money when we were told, basically, after the season ended, that their payroll wouldn't go much significantly above last year's opening day payroll, which is about $114 million. And, you know, I've been doing the math all weekend. And, you know, we don't know the final stats on Ian Kennedy's contract. I'm guessing it's somewhat backloaded. But still, if you add it all up in the arbitration cases, they're going to be over $130 million right now, most likely. And that's a bit of a shocker to me. I thought they would probably stick in the 120s. And I've been told, too, they're not even done yet. They might still have $4 or $5 million left at possibly go out and get a cost-efficient starter or possibly a cost-efficient starting right fielder. So they're still in the game here, and that's kind of been their MO last couple of years, is they don't quit until opening day. They make signings in February. They make signings during spring training in March. And but the Ian Kennedy, yeah, the level of how they committed to him financially is a bit of a surprise, but you know, he's a guy that, you know, they'll probably find a way to slot him in at the number two or number three spot in the rotation. He's a fly ball pitcher. I think over his career, you can see that 40% fly ball. It's a big ballpark. You got maybe the speediest and best outfield in baseball. So it makes sense. And I've been told he really wanted to pitch in front of that defense.
Yeah, he had an abysmal outfield defense. And people talk about Petco factor, and he didn't pitch very well despite having Petco Park in his favor, but he did have a terrible alignment behind him defensively, so he'll certainly stand to improve from that. But, you know, this is a guy that, if there was any guy on that list of people who took the who rejected the qualifying offer and thus were tied to a draft pick, if you had to pick one guy who you would think would be adversely affected by that, be Ian Kennedy. Because, again, he's coming off a bad year on a bad team in a pitcher's ballpark. Lo and behold, he gets 5 years and $70 million, which just goes to show you know, the value of free agent pitching in this marketplace, even for a guy coming off a tough year.
Yeah, and even the surprising part, too, is the Royals are willing to give up their, you know, first-round pick, which is 24 overall. And they're a team that's built on, you know, drafting and developing in the minor leagues. And I guess that was a little bit of a surprise, too. But, you know, they'll be, whatever, 30, 35 more draft picks after the first round. So they're just confident that they'll find enough guys to restock their minor leagues. And, you know, they're committed to this year and next year for sure. You mentioned the window, and there could potentially be a lot of free agents leaving after 2017. So, you know, they're back-to-back pennants, you know, World Series last year. The core is basically all coming back next year and the year after. You know, they're set up now really to make another strong run for the World Series this year and next.
And another move to go with that two-year window, the Lorenzo Cain, you can call it an extension, I guess, so it just basically locks him up through his arbitration year, so that two-year deal.
Yeah, just kind of a good faith deal that they did with Hosmer last year, too. They gave him a two-year deal just to avoid the aggravation of arbitration hearings. Now, they've never gone to an arbitration hearing with Dayton, but they came real close a couple times last year. And you know, Dayton takes care of his players. He just didn't want, you know, that headache over Lorenzo's head the next 2 years. They didn't buy out any free agent years or anything like that. And, you know, I've been told that Lorenzo was hoping, obviously, for a longer-term deal. But they've already committed to Alex Gordon, who's in his 30s. Lorenzo Cain will be in his 30s very soon. And they just couldn't really tie up two guys that long. But, you know, a really good deal for both sides. And that Lorenzo Cain deal, he gets, you know, 6.5 this year, $11 million next year. He'll be set up, and the Royals, you know, have, you know, good faith with him going into 2018 if they, you know, decide then to re-sign him to a longer-term deal.
One more thing on Kennedy that we didn't mention. You know, his numbers against AL teams in his career are somewhat suspect, but he does, of course, have past American League experience and past experience with Dave Island, the pitching coach,
yes,
from his Yankee days. So is that relationship an important one in this deal?
Yeah, it's been quite a while, but, you know, they were together for a couple of years in New York, just like he was together with a couple of years with Wang. So that's another, you know, minor league deal that they signed along with Dylan G. So they're trying to get as many, you know, potential starting pitching candidates that they can. Dayton likes to go into every year with eight at the minimum, and he's probably got eight now. And I'm told they might go out and get someone else, too, and maybe bump it to nine. So, but, yeah, that relationship should help. And, you know, everybody I talked to in the Royals organization the last few years, you know, speaks so highly of Dave Island and what he does with incoming pitchers, you know, what he did with Volquez last year, what he did with Chris Young last year. The guys on the team respect him. They listen to him. They're motivated by him. You know, he suggests mechanical changes that they make. And, you know, their pitching staff has always been solid. It's just going to continue to be solid when he's with him at the pitching coach.
Rhett, you are making your way through Minnesota as part of the Twins caravan. I know it's 5 degrees where you are today, and that's actually an improvement over the first day of the caravan. What's the latest from the road?
Well, right now we're up here in Detroit Lakes. It is definitely been a cold caravan so far, heading up into northern Minnesota. Can head up to Bemidji, end up in Duluth here in a couple days. But so far, it's been great. Really good crowds. I'm on the caravan here with Paul Molitor and Byron Buxton and Casey Fien and Dick Bramer, the Twins play-by-play guy. So, yeah, it's been really good crowds. It's been a lot of fun to see the fans excited. I think with the Twins kind of coming off their first winning season since 2010, I think there's just a little bit more excitement in the air. So, yeah, it's been fun to see all these fans out here at all these places all over Minnesota.
I want to know what that Georgia guy, Buxton, thinks about these sub-zero temperatures you dealt with.
It's pretty hilarious. It's funny because him and then Fien is from L.A. area, just like me.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I went home for Christmas and all that. Jeez, it's been a little bit of a culture shock for me. Even. But, yeah, Buxton was laughing that, you know, back in Georgia, it was like 70 degrees when he left, and he got off the plane here, and it was, I believe on Sunday, it was like negative 15 or whatever it was. But he said even getting off the, you know, that little tunnel, that little walk from the plane to the airport, he said it was just like he started choking almost because he couldn't breathe because it was too cold. So he's doing his best. He's kind of bundling up, but pretty funny to see him out here out of his element a little bit.
Well, Bucks is obviously a big part of the Twins' present and future. Great to see him taking this opportunity to interact with the fans. I'm sure they appreciate that. And kind of in that vein, Rhett, we thought with this week not a ton going on from the hot stove standpoint for the Twins, as far as the Twins are concerned. So I thought we'd do a little getting to know you with some of the new faces for 2016. And, of course, the most prominent new face of all is Jung-ho Park coming over from Korea. Obviously, you've learned quite about him as a player and the numbers he put up in Korea. Have you gotten to know much about Park as far as what he's going to bring to that clubhouse for 2016?
Well, I think Park, it's going to be interesting to see how he fits in. This is a guy from Korea. It's going to be a big change for him culturally coming over to the United States. But he seems like a good guy so far. And I've just been talking to people within the organization. They feel like he's going to be able to fit in that clubhouse. He does know a little bit of English, which should help his transition. And I think just in general, too, we talked about it before, but just that transition of when he gets up into the major leagues and even in spring training, just seeing that higher velocity, seeing just better quality stuff from the pitchers. It's going to be an adjustment. I talked to Paul Molitor here on Caravan yesterday a little bit about it, and he was saying that, you know, when he saw Jun Lo Kong with the Pirates in spring training, offensively he wasn't really that impressed by the guy. I thought, okay, yeah, we can blow some fastballs by him, throw him some breaking balls away, and get him out, and they did. And sure enough, they see him in the season about 2 months later, and I think he hit three home runs off the Twins in about a two-week span in two different series and played really well. And obviously, as we know, finished third in the balloting for NL Rookie of the Year. So I think the Twins with Park want to be patient, both in terms of just fitting in culturally and obviously just his production on the field. And so I think spring training, that's going to be the key, is being patient with him, helping him adjust. I think they're hoping that by, you know, maybe by early May or so, maybe a month into the season, he'll really kind of start to kind of click here. And potentially maybe he'll fit in right away. We'll kind of see how it goes. And the Twins know it's a different situation, you know, having a foreign player like this come aboard like this. But definitely very excited for the potential with the power that he has in the middle of that lineup. So I think that's kind of the excitement part, is you don't really know what you're going to get, but he certainly has the tools and the power to be a force for this Twins team.
I think I saw somewhere where he said he really wants to face Clayton Kershaw. Obviously, there's no no room in the schedule for that unless the two clubs meet in the World Series, but that seems to be a goal of his big league career, is to face Clayton Kershaw, which, you know, not many hitters want to face Clayton Kershaw, period.
Exactly. That's pretty good for him. Yeah, at least he wants to see the best.
Also, Brett, Park's nickname. Do you know Park's nickname in Korea?
You know, I did. I think I saw it on Twitter, but remind me on that one again.
Park Bang.
Okay.
Park Bang. So there you go.
There it is. Perfect.
We'll see that on the Jumbotron at Target Field this summer, I'm sure. another guy who could be a big part of the 2016 fortune, a name we've heard about for a few years now since the Twins took him in the first round, Jose Barrios. And I don't know if he fits in the opening day picture, Rhett, but certainly a guy you could see impacting that rotation before long.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a guy that really shot up a lot of prospect boards. He was obviously considered a top prospect for the Twins as a pitcher coming into the season, but he had such a big season in Double-A and Triple-A that he really established himself as a big pitching prospect for this team, and really probably their best pitching prospect now, despite the fact they've had some pretty good arms there in the minor leagues. I think it's more likely that he'll start out maybe again at Triple-A, get a little more seasoning there, and then come up maybe in early May or so. But you got to figure at some point he's going to be in that rotation, because his upside, you know, too much. I mean, this is a guy that I think last year led all of the minor leagues in strikeouts, and that's definitely something this team has been looking for, you know, in recent years, just because they've had trouble striking out, you know, guys. Like, if they can get a strikeout guy, he's not exactly the typical power pitcher you think of in a sense. And he throws hard and he has a good breaking ball, but he's not the 6'5", you know, big guy. He's more of a 6-foot tall, kind of smaller, diminutive frame, but he gets the most out of that frame. He's turned out to be a big kind of workout freak here in the offseason. But, yeah, he's definitely going to be a big part of this team. I just don't think it's going to be right out of the gate.
Yeah, what's interesting, you know, his numbers only got better when he made that jump from Double-A to Triple-A. But you don't scout numbers. There's always things that the guys are working on. I know sometimes the quote-unquote seasoning at the minor league level is code for, you know, you want to delay the service clock. We know how that game is played quite often. But are there things from what you hear about Barrios as far as specific things he might be working on from a, you know, be it a control standpoint or just deepening his arsenal?
I think you're right. I think he does have to work on some things. I think control is a big part of it, and just kind of commanding those pitches and setting up hitters correctly, because, I mean, the numbers were great down there. But you got to remember, too, in general, you look at the offense in the International League last year, and it was down in general. So I looked at the Twins' overall AAA team ERA was pretty low. I mean, even some guys that aren't considering big prospects, guys like Pat Dean, had great years down there. Some of the numbers kind of can make you look a little better. And so I think in some ways, I think a lot of Twins fans saw the numbers for Barrios, but forgot the fact that he's such a young guy. Barrios is such a young guy that, you know, you never knew what he was going to do up there until he came up in September. And they kind of believe that Tyler Duffy was more ready at the time, and sure enough, he came up and did great. So I think that right now he's got to kind of work on a few things, but you're right. I think in some senses, you know, that service clock can kind of come into play here. The Twins obviously would never admit that, but you got to figure if they can keep him down in the minors for roughly a month or so, they get a whole extra year of control. So I think that's certainly a possibility that could play into it, but the Twins would not, it often would not want to say that, but I do think that spring training for him will be important, but I do think he'll probably start out that year in Triple-A's rotation.
Rosie, haven't caught up with you in a few weeks. The Indians basically did all their heavy lifting for the offseason since we last spoke, so I thought we'd just get your general thoughts
on how things have transpired here. Obviously, there was a great deal of discussion going into the winter about whether or not this club would trade any of its young starting pitching for some offensive help. That obviously has not come to pass, at least not to date. Instead, they went out and found some bargain bin type signings to add to their lineup. So what are your thoughts on the direction they took?
Well, it definitely seems there was a lot of chatter around the winter meetings that players or pitchers like Carlos Carrasco and Danny Salazar, specifically, their names seem to come up most often, were garnering the most interest from other teams. But again, it just sounded like these were calls that the Indians were fielding. They were not actively putting any of their young starting pitchers out there to try and make a deal. But as Chris Antonetti has always said, you got to answer the phone and at least listen to see what's out there. But it just seems like as time has gone by, if there was indeed any thought at any time of moving one of the four, that just the realization of how expensive free agent pitching is and how big a commodity the Indians have in young, controllable, real solid starting pitching at an affordable price, between Chris Antonetti, Mike Chernoff, Terry Francona, they really like it and they want to hang on to it and then figure out a way to improve other parts of the team without moving one of those pitchers. And that certainly appears to be the case heading into the spring now.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've kind of gone round and round on my thoughts on the Indians as this winter has developed, and I've kind of come to the same conclusion that I was an advocate for them moving a starter for a bat at the beginning of this winter, and I for one, did not see the way free agent prices escalated the way they did. I mean, you know David Price is going to get his money, but, I mean, so the other prices on these guys have just been astronomical, and just it hammers home the value that they possess in that rotation. And then the other thing for me, Rosie, was that Shelby Miller trade, which was probably an unrepeatable haul what the Braves were able to turn Shelby Miller into. And it's almost like it made it impossible to make a trade with one of these guys, because if that's what Shelby Miller is worth, what is Carlos Carrasco worth, especially under the terms of his club-friendly contract? It's going to be very hard to find another deal like that, and the Braves were in a really good position to make that deal because, a rebuilding club that could take on a prospect of Dansby Swanson. So long story short, I get where the Indians are coming from with their inaction on that particular front. And then on the free agent front, you know, let's face it, this is not a club that is going to rank in the top 10 or 15 or anything of that nature in attendance. And I just don't see the value in some of the at the top end of free agency, we know it's an inefficient place to do business. And then even the mid-tier, they kind of went that route with Nick Swisher and Michael Bourne a few years back, and we saw both from a performance standpoint, and it's not like, you know, people come clamoring out to the ballpark to see, a Denard Span, for instance, a guy in the mid-tier. So I kind of get where they go with these bargain signings with Mike Napoli and Rajay Davis. There's a lot to like about both of those players, and we saw with the Mets last year. There's something you said for going into the season and what you have, seeing what you have, and developing as you go, because they do have some nice pieces in their system if they did want to make an impact acquisition midseason.
And I think, too, is if you look at the two signings they made were one-year deals.
Yeah.
And you wonder if going back to the Nick Swisher and Michael Bourne signings, which paid off in year one, but certainly did not in year two and then throughout year three, there's those diminishing returns for players of a certain age. It's the way it is, and it's supposed to be in this PED-free time that we're in. You know, you get to 32, 33, and especially power numbers are supposed to decline to some extent. And if you look at most of the free agent deals, they're 4 and 5 years. And I think it's teams that are willing to go for the benefits up front, knowing that it might not be something that'll work out so well in the end. But they're not necessarily worried about years 3, 4, and 5 of those deals.
That's exactly right. Let's do a little getting to know you segment here.
with the new faces here. Mike Napoli, first off, I know you've had a chance to talk with him for your Tribe Talk program, and comes in. Obviously, they hope for great things from his bat in the middle of the order, and they also hope for great things with his glove over at first base. But what can you tell us about Nap as a person, as a player, and you know, what the Indians are getting in this guy at this stage?
Well, the impression I got just in talking to him for one of our other shows was, he's definitely a player with something to prove, and you love to bring in someone like that. Now, is he healthy enough to do that? He seems to be. I think he had a good, strong finish to his season a year ago. There's been, talk about the surgery that he had last off season to his jaw to correct the sleep apnea issue that really set him back, and it wasn't until he got to Texas when he was able to kind of settle in and rediscover some of the things that made him a good power-hitting right-handed bat in the lineups that he's been in. So I think he's looking forward to just having that normal off-season, which he's had so far. It's been a good workout off-season for him. And he also, I think he'll be comfortable here. He got a great recommendation on playing for Terry Francona from his former teammate Dustin Pedroia in Boston. That was one of the first people he called when things were developing, and he said, obviously Pedroia and Terry Francona are very close, and he got a great recommendation. He said, hey, you go play there, and you'll be taken care of, you'll be treated well, and you'll be put in a position to get the most out of what you have. And if he's healthy and can play more than 120 games or so, I think the Indians will be happy with what they have.
Tigers made another huge splash this week with the signing of Justin Upton to a 6-year contract. And Beck, for me, I mean, these quote-unquote surprising moves have ceased to be surprising when it comes to the Tigers, because we've seen Mr. Ilitch dig into those pockets quite often in recent years and pull the rabbit out of the hat, so to speak. Upton just makes this loaded lineup all the more loaded. 28-year-old power hitter, lot to like about this signing. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's going to be nice to have an even higher paid Upton around Tigers camp. The one thing that'll, we hadn't had enough of a presence there. Sorry, I had to get that out somewhere, and I couldn't do it
absolutely,
on TV.
Absolutely, yeah.
So. I guess it's the signing that everybody was anticipating, even if it wasn't necessarily the specific guy. We'd been told, I think by various people all off season, that there wasn't going to be the room for this, that they were trying very hard to stay under a luxury tax, and that if they were gonna bring in an outfielder, it was gonna have to be a short-term deal. Now, depending on how you look at this deal, it could end up just being a 2-year contract if he ends up using the opt-out, which, if he performs well, he can hit the market the year before Bryce Harper and be in line for an even bigger payday. Who knows? But he addresses the position where the Tigers felt like they had their big weakness. And they were able to get a guy. And it's interesting to me to be able to get a guy in his prime years like that, where you can, if it ends up being 2 years, you're getting the guy in his 20s, where he's, and you're not having to pay for the guy in his 30s. Now, if he uses all 6 years, you're still getting him through his early 30s before he gets too terribly old. So it's an interesting deal, and I guess, it's Mike Ilitch's money. He can spend it how he chooses. But if you were gonna do something like this, and from what I'm led to believe, it wasn't something that they were necessarily set on doing until fairly recently. But if you were going to make a deal like this, he seemed like the guy it made sense to do that type of deal for.
Yeah, I preferred Upton over Cespedes in this market, if all things were equal. I mean, I know certain teams were in a better position than others to go after Upton, and the Tigers were one of those as a function of having the protected draft pick. And so that played in their hands. And then, like you mentioned, back the age, this is one of those where I actually like the opt-out from the club perspective, because if he does perform up to the standards everybody hopes for these first 2 years, and then he opts out and hits the open market, I'd be inclined to let somebody else pay for the post 30-year-old power, which is known to wane. So that could work out. You know, even if he does opt out, it could work out for the best for them. But and then the other issue, the luxury tax, which you mentioned, obviously the first year hit is not as punitive as you know, double dipping and going back in future years. And we don't know what the luxury tax is going to be after the next collective bargaining agreement. That's kind of the unknown here.
Yeah, it's an interesting speculative play there, where if it works like past times where the collective bargaining agreement has been redone, then they could end up paying the first time rate in back-to-back years.
Yeah.
Because they went over in 2008, but that was like, what, two CBAs ago or one CBA ago, something like that? And so that doesn't count them as a repeat offender or a repeat taxpayer, however you want to term it. So they can end up paying the low rate, and if the luxury tax threshold goes up, as some people are speculating, they actually could end up paying less, or maybe paying just the minimal amount, depending on what they do with the payroll next year. Now, it's going to be interesting to see how they maneuver some of these contracts, because they're already under long-term deals worth, I think I had them at like 167, 168, maybe closer to 170. And that's not counting the minimum salary guys and the arbitration guys. And remember, Nick Castellanos, assuming he spends a full year in the big leagues this year, would be arbitration eligible. So they're going to have some heavy lifting to do there. But if you're going to go into that territory, you're not diving into where you're going to have to pay that 30-40% rate. At least it doesn't look like it for now. We'll see what happens down the road.
Do you think this precludes them from a J.D. Martinez extension? That's something that obviously been in the air before this signing went down.
I've been trying to figure it out, and I don't know. I know it's not the answer people want to hear, and it creates a lot of uncertainty with this team. On the one hand, if you look at it as a six-year deal, it's hard to see how they have the space for J.D. Martinez. If you look at it as a two-year deal, then Upton and J.D. Martinez would be eligible for free agency at the same time. And in theory, you could sign one of them. I'd have a hard time, assuming they keep performing at their levels, seeing them both being able to resign here. It was interesting that they weren't able to get a long-term deal done before this. I don't know how hard they tried. I'd been given every indication that they had been talking about it, but when you're $2 million apart on arbitration offers, just on your fifth major league season, then I think it's they might have decided they have some work to do on those grounds anyways, and that it might be easier for them to revisit closer to free agency, although it's hard to see them getting much of a discount that way.
Well, Beck, as you know, we were going to do a getting to know you theme with this week's podcast, and Tigers kind of blew that up by adding another new body to the mix. But looking back at what they had previously done this winter, Jordan Zimmermann comes aboard, was the first of the over $100 million signings. I believe the Tigers are just the second team in history. They have $200 million guys in the same offseason, by the way. But Zimmermann, what should people know about Zimmermann beyond the obvious that he's an upgrade for this rotation?
Well, he's a Midwestern guy. He's clearly a Packers fan, as those who followed him on Twitter are quickly realizing. He got a little bit of hot water there after the Packers Hail Mary win over the Lions back in December. For somebody who's had the Tommy John surgery, he's quite durable. And I think that's what impresses me from that standpoint, that if you look at the years since the Tommy John, if, aside from the partial season in 2011, he's averaged 200 innings a year the last 4 years. And I haven't had a chance to look up, you know, the track record of those guys, how many guys have been able to do that for four straight years after Tommy John. But I have to think it's a pretty fly club.
Let's move on to happier subjects. The White Sox, of course, made a couple big acquisitions this winter, and we're taking a getting-to-know-you theme with this week's podcast. So let's start with Todd Frazier. And, you know, we know the numbers, and I'm sure since this acquisition you've, you know, done quite a bit of studying up on Todd Frazier, the person and the player. But what intrigues you about him, and what do you, as you gear up to go cover another spring training camp, what are you excited to learn about him?
Well, one thing is he seems like a major college basketball fan, as I saw on Twitter last night that he was at the Duke-Syracuse game. So, you know, that's kind of one of the meccas of college basketball, so you appreciate that. But, you know, I think the biggest thing, and this is no offense to the guys who have held spots before them because they've all had, you know, some moments, but I think he's going to provide consistency both offensively and defensively for the first time since Joe Creedy was over at third base. And it's a big spot. You know, they had too many, I don't want to say automatic outs, but they had too many spots in the lineup last year where they just couldn't count on consistent offense. And some would argue they still have too many of them, but I think it's improved. And I think Frazier is, you know, maybe one of the bigger acquisitions overall in terms of what he means to the team and the position he's filling for any team in the offseason, I think. You know, just not just an impact bat, not just a guy who's going to hit his share of long balls and home runs at U.S. Cellular Field, but good defensive third baseman, which they, you know, struggled with at the beginning of last year. Connor Gillespie had some plantar fasciitis issues and really kind of put them in a hole early. Part of the overall thing, it wasn't just Connor Gillespie, but also a good athlete, and from what I hear, a great clubhouse guy. So it was a, you know, they gave up three solid young players, but it was the move they had to make to take a step forward.
Yeah, I think you're going to enjoy covering Todd Frazier very much. Very, very fun guy, very nice guy, and a terrific player at a premium position. Speaking of premium positions, though, shortstop, it doesn't appear Tim Anderson will be in the opening day outlook, but you could certainly make a case that he'll be an important player for the White Sox, you know, maybe as soon as 2016. What do you know about Tim Anderson, you know, strengths, weaknesses in his game? Because obviously this could be this year could be the first chance for the casual White Sox fan to get a real look at him.
You know, I've read a couple times in the offseason that the Sox should take a look at him, even out of spring training. And trust me, they look at everyone, and, you know, they'll give opportunities. If they're not shy on promoting people if the time is right and they earn the spot. They have a good defensive guy and a guy who can hit a little bit, you know, when given the chance, in Tyler Saladino. But I think Anderson really has that chance to be a dynamic presence in the lineup. You know, just kind of all parts of the offense. Has a little bit of extra base power, has great speed. The thing with Tim, though, is he doesn't have a ton of baseball experience. He came from, you know, he was drafted after just 2 years at junior college. He was a basketball player also in high school. So the biggest focus on him is, could he stay at short? You draft these guys who are considered, you know, quote-unquote athletes, more so than baseball experience. And you start hearing, well, he made, you know, 22 errors in his first 63 games at short. You know, that's a center fielder with all his athleticism. Maybe they'll move him to center. But to Tim's credit, he was dead set against that, and he fought to kind of earn that, you know, position. And Rick Hahn talked about this, White Sox general manager Rick Hahn talked about this during the year, and that, you know, he went from kind of questionable at the first part to now at this point into his, you know, a couple years into his tenure in the White Sox system where, you know, he belongs there. Yeah, I mean, he's got tons of room to develop, obviously, but people are now looking at him, you know, outside the organization as a shortstop as well. You're not hearing the rumblings you used to about, well, I mean, he's better suited in another position. This appears to be the White Sox shortstop of the future and maybe the present in the not-too-distant, you know, future.
Yeah, just from a raw error count, he made some strides, it looks like, last season at a double-A level. Another new face, Merck, is in the TV booth. Jason Benetti replacing Hawk Harrelson for home games this year. What can you tell us about Benetti and this arrangement where the Hawk will be road games only?
Well, I think Benetti gets home games in the Toronto series, and Hawk has home opener, road games, and the two Cubs-Sox games, I believe, at U.S. Cellular Field. Benetti, I have to say, some pride for myself because he went to the same high school as I did, Homewood Plossmoor High School. He also was part of the same great radio program, one of the best high school radio programs in the country, WHFH, and that produced like four or five people covering sports in the Chicago market right now, including my youngest brother, who's assistant program director at a radio station, sports radio station in Chicago. But, you know, he sounds like a good kid. I listened to him on the Michigan State-Iowa basketball game. He does work for ESPN. And interesting story. You know, I don't think he wants this to be the focus, but he doesn't shy away from it. But he does have cerebral palsy, and he has, you know, reached out. I don't know if he serves as kind of a role model or an inspiration as much as he just shows that, you know, it's something you deal with and you tackle the challenge and move on and just live life. But remember when you talk to him, he's a very good announcer. And I think it's going to be different styles. You know, as Brooks Boyer said, who kind of oversees the broadcasting, you know, Hawk is more of a storyteller. We all know that. And, you know, draws on his many, many decades of experience throughout baseball. And Jason's going to be more the, I think, prototypical play-by-play man, more kind of the setup to Steve Stone, who is back as the analyst for the broadcast. So I think it's a good combination for both teams. And Hawk is excited about it. Hawk, you know, has an interesting situation where he lives near South Bend, Indiana, home of the Fighting Irish, which is about a 95-mile drive in either direction. He would make that commute back and forth. As a matter of fact, many times he'd tell me that he'd put on a Sirius on the drive home and listen to his buddy Vin Scully calling the Dodgers game. But he, it just became a little tiring. So that's why instead of taking the home games, he, you know, chose to do the road games. And he lives in South Bend because that's where his grandkids live, and he wants to be closer to them. And this split will provide him with more time. And, you know, an interesting little side note is that he's going to sort of be the few home games he attends or whatever home games he decides to attend, he's going to be sort of an unofficial ambassador where he'll be able to deal with the fans and that kind of thing. He won't be in the booth, but he'll be able to, you know, talk to the White Sox Nation there. So it's an interesting move, and it was one that Fox said he started thinking about before the 15 season. He was so excited by the moves Rick Hahn made, he decided to stay for the whole thing, and it just seemed like the right time now to make the change.